Today's Taisho will be on Case 2 in the Pi Yen Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 2 is entitled Joshu's The Real Way Is Not Difficult. Engo's introduction: the universe is too narrow. The sun, moon, and stars are all at once darkened. Even if blows from the stick fall like raindrops and katsu shouts sound like thunder, you are still far from the truth of Buddhism. Even the Buddhas of the three worlds can only nod to themselves, and the ancestors of all ages do not exhaustively demonstrate its profundity. The whole treasury of sutras is inadequate to expound its meaning. Even the clearest-eyed monks fail to say themselves, at this point, how do you conduct yourself? Mentioning the name of Buddha is like trudging through the mud. To utter the word Zen is to cover your face with shame. Not only those who have long practiced Zen, but beginners too, should exert themselves to attain directly to the secret. Main subject: Joshu spoke to the assembly and said, the great way is not difficult. It only abhors choice and attachment. But with a single word, there may arise choice and attachment, or there may arise clarity. This old monk does not have that clarity. Do you appreciate the meaning of this or not? Then a monk asked, if you do not have that clarity, what do you appreciate? Joshu said, I don't know that either. The monk said, if you do not know, how can you say you do not have that clarity? Joshu said, asking the question is good enough. Now make your bows and retire. Secho's verse, the great way is not difficult. Direct word, direct speech. One with many phases, two with one. Far away in the heavens, the sun rises, the moon sets. Beyond the hills, the high mountains, the cold waters. The skull has no consciousness, no delight. The dead tree sings in the wind, not yet rotten. Difficult, difficult. Attachment and clarity. Watch and penetrate the secret. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. I don't know if you saw there was an article in Newsweek magazine. I myself am not a big fan of Newsweek magazine, but I came across this article in Newsweek that was about the Dalai Lama, and I highly recommend it. I am very interested in Buddhism, as you know. And one of the things I do after I meditate and while I'm eating my breakfast, sometimes I will go online and I will Google Buddhism, and then I will Google news and see what the news is in the world of Buddhism. Usually, it's just a bunch of junk, but every once in a while, there's something that's interesting and important. And there was an article on the Dalai Lama by some reporter in Newsweek. And the article was so interesting because, I myself tend to think of the Dalai Lama as a person who is above it all, you know. We all probably think of him that way sometimes, you know. When the Dalai Lama came here to Rutgers, this was maybe 8 years ago. Attracted so many people that they had to book the stadium, and it was like a major extravaganza. And all these people, like thousands and thousands of people, went to see the Dalai Lama. And you know, the Dalai Lama has a public persona that he uses when he's in places where his teachings are not likely to be understood. You know, he can be very funny and disarming. He's kind of a comedian. And he seems like a very happy person. And indeed, I think he is a very happy person. But he giggles, he makes jokes, he says things that are sort of whimsical. And often this is a big hit. So, you know, people form an image of the Dalai Lama. If you see pictures of the Dalai Lama in the paper, you know, he's often smiling or he's often laughing. And the article was saying this is sort of the public image of the Dalai Lama as somebody who's always smiling, always laughing. And, you know, we might idealize the Dalai Lama. We might say, you know, he's somebody who's really like, he's above it all, you know. So, you know, if we're having problems in our life, you know, we can sometimes feel like we're just barely hanging on. You know, just hanging on, trying to cope, trying to deal. Things happen to us all the time, and we can feel overwhelmed, right? This happens. You know, we can feel overwhelmed. We can feel defeated. We can feel that we can't win. All of these feelings that we normally have. You know, and maybe we happen to read a newspaper or we happen to see a story on television about the Dalai Lama and he's laughing and he seems so happy. So the article was really sort of saying this is how we look at the Dalai Lama. We have an image of the Dalai Lama as this always, he makes it look easy. Makes it look easy, right? He's always happy, always smiling. And you know, all those 20,000 people who came, or 30,000 people who came to see the Dalai Lama in the stadium, many of them had never heard a word of his particular teachings. They hadn't read any books on Buddhism. A lot of them just came because there was a lot of PR, and they had vaguely heard of the Dalai Lama, and it was an opportunity to go to hear this interesting man. You know, the speech he gave at Rutgers was actually very empty, you know, not like in a Buddhist sense, but it was just it didn't have much content. It was funny and it was a little bit entertaining, but there wasn't really much of a there, you know. So, you know, it's possible to think of the Dalai Lama as this guy who's always happy and it's effortless for him. And then on the other hand, you know, we down here are struggling, you know. And, about a year ago, my sister-in-law, who is an admirer of the Dalai Lama, you know, set her house on fire. She works for Trader Joe's, but on the side, she's quite a very skillful jewelry maker. And she uses an acetylene torch. And the acetylene torch was defective, and it fortunately nobody was hurt. But she had been making jewelry in her workshop in the house, and somehow the torch, it didn't exactly blow up, but it started putting out like a spray of flame, and her house caught on fire. You know, and so they had to call the fire trucks. There was all this water damage. I know basically she has like a little, she has a picture of the Dalai Lama. And I'm sure it helped her get through all of this because she doesn't really practice, but I think she, you know, she would, maybe sometimes she would look at that picture, she would think, you know, when she just looked at the Dalai Lama, it would probably make her feel calmer and better, you know, like, somewhere, somebody isn't having to cope with all this craziness, you know. And I think the Dalai Lama plays that role. And the article was saying, you know, he has a public persona, a public personality, as somebody who's like above it all. You know, he's above it all. And we might think we are struggling down here, and he's up there, carefree, right? And you know, maybe some people get into meditation because they think, you know, if I just do meditation, I can be like the Dalai Lama. I can be carefree, you know. So You know, the story had a title. It was something like this, the Dalai Lama. It wasn't quite like the Dalai Lama is really made of steel or something like that. But that was the idea. The idea of the article was that, you know, we think of the Dalai Lama as sort of like the Pillsbury Doughboy, but actually he's made of steel. That was sort of the idea of the article. And they talked about his life experience, you know, and how difficult it has been to do what he's done. You know, and I was just, when I read, as I say, I normally don't like Newsweek. It's politically pretty conservative. I'm more on the left of the political spectrum. So Newsweek is something I usually stay away from, or when I read it, I find it upsetting. But this article was so interesting because, you know, we don't, you know, they talked about the fact that the Dalai Lama's country, Tibet, was invaded by the Chinese, and that he had to flee, and that when he fled from Tibet into northern India, you know, the Chinese pretty much had kept all the wealth in the country, all the wealth there was in Tibet. And the Dalai Lama and his retinue, they were pretty much almost penniless, you know. You know, they talked about the fact that the Tibetan community really had to rebuild with almost nothing. And it, you could easily see how a person in the Dalai Lama's situation could get, you know, depressed, right? Depressed. You know, his country is invaded by foreign invaders. And actually, it was quite a ruinous experience for Tibet. You know, some people estimate that the Tibetans lost a quarter of their population. And the Dalai Lama wound up in northern India really almost broke, you know. And the Tibetan community, the emigre community, had very few financial resources. And they're in a foreign country. You know, and if I myself have never been to Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama lives in India. But, you know, people who go tell me it's really quite a wonderful place. You know, the Tibetans really worked very, very hard to make a new life in Dharamsala. And the Dalai Lama, you know, had to keep his people together, had to keep the Tibetans together, and it wasn't easy. And he'd had to try to get some political leverage against the Chinese, you know, even though he had no resources, you know. And so they talk about, the article talks about the fact that, you know, the Dalai Lama basically has no real power at all. You know, there's a Tibetan government in exile, but it's really just a symbolic government. And the article points out the Pope, the Dalai Lama is not like the Pope, right? I mean, many people don't know this. If you're not in the world of Buddhism, many people think the Dalai Lama is like the Buddhist Pope. But the article points out that the Dalai Lama is respected in the Buddhist world, but he's not the ecclesiastical leader of the Buddhist world. So Zen Buddhists respect the Dalai Lama, but they don't see him the same way, say, Jesuits see the Pope, or, you know, Franciscans see the Pope. No matter what your order in, say, the Catholic Church, the Pope is the boss, right? And Buddhism doesn't have a boss like that. So, and even in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, actually, people don't realize, but the Dalai Lama isn't really the head of Tibetan Buddhism. You know, there's different schools of Tibetan Buddhism, and they all have their own structures. And the Dalai Lama is actually just the head of one group of one tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, the Gelugpa tradition. So there's the others, the Nyingma tradition. There are a number of other schools, and they have their own sort of ecclesiastical leaders or their own heads, you know. So the Dalai Lama really has no political authority, really, and he has very little ecclesiastical authority. He's really not like the Pope. And they said, you know, when he fled Tibet, They were basically the Tibetan emigre community was living in North India, and they had almost no money. And the Dalai Lama really had almost no power. You know, he's just this monk who's the head of this order, which was the most important school of Buddhism in Tibet. But nevertheless, you know, he wasn't the Pope. And they said, you know, what he's managed to do with really nothing is to turn himself into a world statesman, really like one of the leading world statesmen, and really one of the leading religious figures in the world, even though he has nothing to go on except his own, basically his own presence, you know. And they talked about how difficult all of this was to achieve. You know, that when we think about the Dalai Lama, we think of this guy who's always smiling and always happy, and we don't see him sweating. You know, we don't see the sweat that it took to build Dharamsala and the sacrifice and the hard work. And we don't necessarily see the Dalai Lama, what it's taken for the Dalai Lama to be the Dalai Lama, because he makes it all look so effortless, you know. And they say, you know, really, the Dalai Lama has a very difficult time with the Chinese. He's fought a long struggle with the mainland Chinese, trying to protect what's left of his country. And he's gone all over the world. He meets with presidents and prime ministers. And he uses his non-existent political power as leverage to get advantages for his people in Tibet. And he's actually done a brilliant job at this. You know, he goes to parliaments and congresses, and he delivers addresses, and people treat him like a head of state, even though he really has no real authority. And he's managed to build his authority or his presence in the world and use that to protect his people, even though he had nothing to work with, you know. And they also talk about the fact that even in the Tibetan community, you know, the Dalai Lama is not immune to criticism. So you may or may not know that within the Tibetan community, there's a very disgruntled faction. They're very well represented in the United States. So there's I think it's called the KMT, but there's a sort of a, there's a faction of the Gelugpa led by this man whose name escapes me right now, who are very unhappy about the Dalai Lama because he prohibited some rituals associated with this rather destructive deity. And the Dalai Lama was very uncomfortable with this tradition of worshiping this destructive or invoking this destructive deity. And he said, this really isn't Buddhism. You know, this is really not a healthy practice for people. And so he basically tried to eliminate this from the monastic curriculum of Gelugpa Buddhism. And then there were some people who went on the war path against the Dalai Lama. And so now when the Dalai Lama goes to different places, you'll see that there's actually protesters. In the old days, they used to be mainland Chinese. But now they're actually like in Tibetan robes and things, and you'll wonder, what's that all about? And even when in the comments section of this article, there were people writing in saying the Dalai Lama is a feudal overlord. He oppresses the KMT, you know, what a bad man he is, and so on. So, you know, the article was talking about the fact that, you know, he was left with nothing. You know, he built a government in exile when they had nothing. He created a government in exile. He's in some ways the head of the government in exile, but it's really not much. There's not much there. It just looks like a lot. And they have a little parliament, but it's a very small population. You know. And then he's managed to become this world figure just through his determination, his courage, and his integrity. right? And also great intelligence, right? Great, incredible intelligence. So he's managed to do all these things with nothing. And he's been in a constant battle with the mainland Chinese, the communist Chinese. And he's been in a constant, he's actually embroiled in this battle with this dissident sect in the Gelugpa, who are really quite mean. You know, I think they're very cult-like myself. And really, their criticisms are way, you know, totally ridiculous, I think. And the guy who runs it, I think, is sort of like a bad man, you know? I mean, I think he is. I think he's like sort of a very narrow-minded, like a Tibetan fundamentalist, basically. So this is the Dalai Lama's world. You know, the Dalai Lama gets up every morning and he meditates 3 or 4 hours a day. And if you buy the image of the Dalai Lama that he himself has kind of created as this guy who's above it all, you know, you'll wonder, what does he have to meditate about, right? He's already in heaven, right? He's already in this beautiful place. But, you know, the Dalai Lama actually has to deal with all these challenges every day, you know. He has to deal with, you know, a lot of Tibetans in exile in India, you know, get into a bad situation. You know, they're confused culturally. You know, drugs, alcohol, these are big problems for the Tibetan emigre community. You know, the Dalai Lama tries to deal with those kinds of problems, you know. And it has to bother him, right? So he sits down on the cushion. You know, recently I was reading that the mainland Chinese are engaging in a new sort of like terror campaign in Tibet. And a lot of the political leadership in Tibet, all these people who are political leaders within the communist Chinese system, have actually been very sympathetic to the Dalai Lama because they're Tibetan. And now they're being punished. Some of them are going to jail. So, you know, if you were the Dalai Lama and you read that, you know, you would have to do some meditation, you know. So you're dealing with young people in Tibet who are going to prison because of their religious beliefs. You're dealing with young people in India who are culturally confused and don't know who they are or what they are. And they're on drugs, or they're getting into trouble, crime, gangs, right? You know, so this is the real world of the Dalai Lama. It's not the world we might imagine. And the article actually says, you know, the Dalai Lama now, he usually gives a public talk, and he gives a private talk for people who are interested in Buddhism. So the Dalai Lama, and I've seen him do that myself when he came to the University of Washington, he gave like a public talk, which was like his sort of like a funny, affable talk, and it was he was charming and engaging. He was giggling, you know, and then, you know, after the public talk, a lot of people left, and then the people who were interested in Buddhism stayed behind, and he actually gave like this very, very tightly wound talk on a particular set of teachings. And he was like a professor, you know, he was just laying it out, explaining it in great detail. He has like an encyclopedia in his head. And they said, you know, he learned how to do that early on, because when he would try to address these stadiums and talk about Buddhist ideas, you know, people would all start going to sleep at once. So he realized this is not going to work, right? You've got to make it entertain. It has to be entertaining for the mass media, right? So he came up with this very funny persona, sort of the Dalai Lama as a comedian. You know, so the real Dalai Lama is a very complex figure. And if we don't buy into the sort of mythical Dalai Lama, we understand why it's necessary, if you want to be a bodhisattva, to do a lot of meditation. This is true for us too, you know. The image of Buddhism is a happiness, right? Actually, we don't do it so much in Zen, but in Theravada Buddhism, whenever they end any kind of invocation, they always say, may all beings be happy. And the Dalai Lama has written books on happiness. Let's be happy. You know, so when people associate Buddhism with, you know, people associate Buddhism with happiness, as they should, because, you know, about a week ago we finished a sesshin, or 2 weeks ago. And I have to tell you, if you do sesshin long enough, it's like heaven. You know, it's very happy. But, you know, to get to that place, you have to do a lot of work. And that's the part people don't always pay attention to. You know, if you want to get to that place where it's effortless, you have to put in a lot of effort. You know, and if you don't put in the effort, you're not going to get to that place. You know, Zen practice or any kind of Buddhist practice generally means that you're pushing at your boundaries. You know, you don't become a more open person just by sitting on a cushion and entering samadhi. You know, that's not how it's done. That's not the way. You know, there are people who meditate that way. They practice just to get to samadhi. You get sort of like a buzz on. You know, I don't know if people use that word anymore, but when we were young and in college, people used to smoke marijuana and they'd say, oh, I'm feeling a buzz, right? You know, that means sort of a blissful feeling. But it's possible to meditate that way too. You get to this place where you have a deep relaxation response and then, you know, you begin to feel better and you have sort of a little bliss and that's a samadhi experience, you know, and you can stop there and that's great, you know. But actually, not much can be accomplished in that condition. It's like relief. It's a relief to be in samadhi. But people who practice Buddhism have to push at their boundaries. You have to push at the boundaries. You know, so you become a more open person by pushing at your boundaries, right? And so, basically, the Dalai Lama really is somebody who's, in a certain way, made of steel, right? I'm not sure I like that idea, the Dalai Lama as a person made of steel. But I think the Dalai Lama is a person who has a great deal of self-discipline, you know, a lot of self-discipline, and has developed a kind of fearlessness, you know? And there are other characteristics too that I want to get to in a minute, but those two are really important, you know. So, for example, everybody in this room got up this morning on a Saturday, and it was cold this morning. It's cold. It was like 10 degrees out. You know, when you wake up on a Saturday and it's 10 degrees, you know, oh my God, it's so cold out there. You want to pull the sheets over your head, but you know. You get up and you realize, okay, the cold isn't going to destroy me. You know, it's okay to be cold. You know, and you could be cold. You know, and after a while, you're all right with that. You know, and you can be a little sleepy. You say, well, you know, I'm sleepy, but you know, the sleep isn't going to destroy me. You know, it's not going to kill me to miss an hour of sleep on a Saturday. So you got up and you came here, and you sat down on the cushion and you meditated. And so, you know, that takes self-discipline. People come in here periodically, and they sit, you know, and then they come back, and their sitting doesn't seem to be any better, you know. So there are a number of people who come here regularly, and they'll come, and, you know, after about 15 or 20 minutes, they really have to start moving. And they'll keep moving until the sit is over, and then... next sit, same thing. And then, you know, a week later, they'll come back and same thing. Another week later, same thing. You know, and it's like, and I'll say, are you practicing on your own? No. I don't know what they expect, right? Because, basically, you can't develop deep concentration if you don't practice, right? It's not a magical process. You really have to put in the time. You know, so self-discipline is indispensable. You know, and I think Zen is better training than the army. You know, I haven't been in the army, but you know, when you say, I'm going to get up, one of our members, he now lives in California. When he first came to beginning Zen, he could do 5 or 10 minutes and he would be wiped out. But, you know, he made a pledge that he was going to start meditating every morning, and he got up every morning and he would start meditating for, at first it was just like for 15 minutes. And by the time, a couple years later, he was doing like an hour every morning. And this guy had a very demanding job. He was a postman. And, you know, those guys actually have a really difficult job. You're on your feet all day. You have to get to work really early. And the hours are pretty long. But he made a point of getting up in the morning and doing zazen. And you know, I myself, before I really got into Zen, I very rarely got up early in the morning. In fact, almost, I never, you know. But when I began to train with Genki Roshi, he began to encourage me to come and sit in the mornings. And that meant that I had to get up at 4:30 in the morning. And I was going to graduate school, you know, and I had a lot of demands on my time. I got up at 4:30 in the morning, and I would, you know, have a little something to eat and a snack and wash up and get to Kugeon, Roshi's house. At that time, we were sitting at his house. And we would all sit in the freezing cold, starting at 5:30 in the morning until 7, and then we'd have like a Japanese breakfast. And sometimes in the afternoon I would be so tired, you know, either I would take a nap or I would have to, when I was grading papers, if you're an English TA, you just grade papers. I would keep the radio on so I wouldn't fall asleep. But you know, first of all, I developed a great capacity to work, you know. I developed this ability to like do sustained work, and I still get up very early, you know. And I think that self-discipline is really wonderful. You know, it's like you think you have these barriers in yourself or these boundaries in yourself. You know, I couldn't do that. And then you know you realize I can do this. It's not a problem. And you're, you know, when you crash through a boundary like that, you know, you're a freer person. You're freer. You know, so I do know people who just, the idea of getting up at 4:30 in the morning is literally like unthinkable. And, you know, I'll meet people who say, oh my God, you know, I'll be at work and I'll run into people and it's like 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock and people have to come to an early meeting at 9. And how are you? Oh, 9 o'clock, you know. I've got to have some coffee, you know. I mean, and sometimes we say these things just to be sociable. But this is like, you know, on a certain level, you think, are you kidding? You know. So basically, you know, you realize I can get up at 4:30. I don't need coffee to function, you know. And that's a door open in yourself. Now you're freer. Something you're not afraid of. It's small. But it's something you're not afraid of, and you know you can do it. You know, so having self-discipline, you know, sitting for an hour and a half, you know, I'll never forget the first time I sat for an hour and a half. I used to sit for, half an hour. And I would sit there and think, ring the bell, please ring the bell. And, you know, I practiced enough so I could get into really deep concentration. And I remember once the bell rang, and I thought, you know, I wonder what would happen if I don't move and I sit through the bell and I sit to the next bell, you know. And I was, it was terrifying, you know, because I can always uncross my legs, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to see if I could keep my concentration so powerfully focused that I could get through the next sit and not move. And I did. And I remember even thinking, I wonder what would happen if I didn't move for the next. And I did, you know. Now, this is a small thing, but I think it creates a mental habit, right? You know, we develop these fears we develop these we say, I can't cross this line in myself. You know, I can't. I'll crack. I'll break up. You know, and you meet people who are very fragile. You know, very fragile. I've known people who have very ritualized lives, right? They get up at a certain time, they have to have a cup of coffee at a certain time. And if it doesn't happen, it's all out of control. You know, so it's very interesting, you know, to crash through some of these boundaries in ourselves. It takes self-discipline to do that, right? But when you realize you're not destroyed by something, you have a kind of a power or a resilience that you didn't have before. So, you know, at this last session, we had a number of people who came for the first time to session, and you know, first time you come to Sesshin, it's almost unthinkable, right? It's like, I could never do that. You get up at 4:30, you meditate for 8 hours a day. You know, I could never do that. So it's like there's a boundary, there's a line. I've drawn a line, and I can't cross it, or I'll crack. I'll be destroyed. You know. But you cross it, and then you realize, not only am I not destroyed, I'm doing pretty well. You know, so in a way, this is like the rhythm of Zen training, you know, or actually all Buddhist training. You know, different Buddhisms use different strategies, you know, nobody becomes awake just by sitting in samadhi. That will never happen. It will never happen till the end of time, you know. So none of the Buddhist schools say just get into samadhi and you're there. There are actually schools that say that, but not in Buddhism. You know, when we say you're in samadhi, it's like, now you're ready to start. And then what we start doing is poking at these barriers in ourselves. This is what koans are designed to do, right? And so, you know, basically, you know, many people are uncomfortable with that. You know, lots of people quit doing Zen at the stage where you try to move them out of their samadhi, out of their comfort zone, and get them to begin to work on their barriers. But that's really crucial. Nothing can happen unless you start crossing those lines in yourself. And small things lead to a greater and greater capacity to do this. So, you know, just getting up today early and coming here was like crossing a line in yourself, you know. And maybe the first time you've ever sat for 3 hours was like crossing a line in yourself. And maybe afterwards you were really tired, you know, you're really tired. But, you know, if you do it again, you won't be so tired. You develop this resilience, this capacity to handle challenges, right? And I think that's really what the article should have said. You know, instead of the stainless steel Dalai Lama, you know, I think steel doesn't get at it. And a lot of people misunderstand Zen too. You know, we Zen people like to sit for long periods of time. So it's possible that people think we're sort of militaristic. I've had people come to our sesshins, you know, and, you know, we get up at 4:30, you show up in the zendo at 5, and some people think, you know, this is like the military. You guys are like, but that's not the point. The point is, you know, learning, you become more free if you cross a barrier in yourself. See, you cross a barrier in yourself. And meditation practice is a way of crossing these barriers, you know, in a whole body way. You know, I think we're using our whole body mind complex on the cushion. And so, you know, you develop this resilience, and you develop this when you realize you're not destroyed by a challenge. You know, that's the thing. You're not destroyed. You sit for an hour and a half, and my, you know, you weren't destroyed. Your legs hurt, but you weren't destroyed. You know, you were sleepy, but you aren't destroyed. And you know, on the other side of that, when you cross a barrier in yourself and you realize you haven't been destroyed, what usually happens then is there's like this great feeling of freedom and joy. Right? Joy, you know. So, you know, I think this happens to people around day three of Sesshin. You know, day one, people come and they're thinking, I don't know what I've gotten into. You know, day two, your legs really hurt. And you think, this, I can't do this, right? There's a barrier in myself I can't cross. And around day three, people break through that barrier, and then there's this feeling of, like, elation, you know, a victory. It's like coming the last mile of the marathon. But on the other side of it, that you have gained a greater trust in life, you know, and trust in yourself. You know, a lot of the time we just don't trust ourselves, right? You know, we construct ourselves as fragile creatures who can't handle change or challenges, right? And I think Zen is really good at creating a kind of resilience. You know, when the worst things happen, you know, you're okay. You know, you're okay. I mean, in the Buddhist point of view, even dying, you know, the worst thing happens, you die, you're still okay. You know, so there's a lot at stake just getting up in the morning. There's a lot at stake just sitting still for half an hour. And, you know, sometimes we have physical discomfort, but even that's a barrier in ourselves, right? I mean, you know, the presence of pain creates like an instinctive panic response, right? When we feel pain, we want to, there's that fight or flight, right? So, when your leg is hurting and the bell isn't ringing, you know, you might be sending me telepathic thoughts, you might be hating me at that moment, you know. But you can't really fight, right? That's not really appropriate. So then there's flight. You know, you could get up and run out of the room. But you can't do either of these things, so you're sort of trapped. And what we want to do is move our leg, right? And if you move your leg, it's okay. But if you don't move your leg, you aren't destroyed, see? And then, you know, oddly, the pain sensation begins to diminish. And there's this sense of, it's like freedom. Freedom. I didn't back down from this, right? So, you know, when we think about Zen practice or Buddhism or the Dalai Lama, you know, may all beings be happy, but how do we get to happiness? And the road to happiness isn't, road to happiness is a challenging road, you know. It means being disciplined. Working through our barriers, right? But that allows us to develop a kind of trust in life. And there's another aspect of Zen practice that I think is really important, you know, and that people, especially younger people, don't understand. You know, I was talking about this at the Sesshin, but a lot of young people, when I was, I used to teach Zen over at Princeton. And the Princeton students were very different from the Rutgers students. Because, I would get a new group of people in the Zendo at Princeton. And they would all, I'd teach them how to sit, how to breathe. And we'd do two periods of meditation. And I'd say, how did that go? And they'd say, oh, wonderful. I'd say, well, please come back next week. And none of them would come back. None. Zero. A new group would come. And I'd say, hello, how are you? Fine. You know, interested in Zen? Yes. I'd make jokes. They'd laugh. We'd meditate for two periods. How did that go? Wonderful. Please come back. Oh, I'll be here next week. Nobody came back. See, now at Rutgers, it's a little different, you know. Rutgers, the percentage is a little better. You know, maybe 10 people come, 4 people say they're coming back, 1 person comes back. You know, after a while, though, you have like 14 people in a room. But at Princeton, it never got like that. It was always the same 0, right? So I have a friend of mine, and I said to her, she's from Princeton, she graduated from Princeton. I said, what is it with Princeton students? You know, I don't seem to be able, am I not intellectual enough for these people? And she laughed and she said, are you kidding? She said, these people are dilettantes. You know, their whole culture is dilettante culture. In other words, they do a little of of this, they do a little of that, they do a little of this. You know, so, it, you know, they now they can, she said, you were on their bucket list, right? Now they've done Zen. Now it's on to this. Now it's on to this, right? And, you know, Monday is, you know, anti-nuclear demonstration. You know, Tuesday is maybe yoga. Wednesday, I'll give Zen a try. Thursday, this, you know, and they're all very busy all the time. Busy, busy, busy. And she said, that's how they're very, you know, we would say very superficial. See, now, my feeling is that was about 10 or 15 years ago. My feeling is that young people in general are becoming more and more like that. Not just at Princeton, but here too. They're all very busy, right? And they have many things going on. And somebody told me, actually, you know, it's because they're worried they're missing something. And I think the internet does that in some ways, right? You know, I mean, people are constantly on their phones, they're constantly texting, and they're checking Facebook, you know, and it's like something somewhere else is going on that's more important than what's going on right here, right? That's going on right here. And I think that's like that is truly a mental illness. That is truly a mental illness. And the internet is creating a mental illness. You know, that no matter where you are, you could be or should be somewhere else or know what's going on there right now. And that is really the essence of an unhappy mind. That's like a samsaric mind. So Zen is about being here 100%. See, not checking your iPhone, looking at your Facebook page to see who's doing what. It's being here without any conditions or expectations, 100%. But it's also, the practice is also about open-heartedness or wholeheartedness, you know. If you want to do Zen, do Zen. If you don't want to do Zen, don't do Zen. But you can't do Zen a little bit, right? You can't. You know, last night there was a guy who came, and I hadn't seen him in 6 months. And I said, have you ever been here before? He said, yeah, don't you remember me? I was here 6 months ago. I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't remember you. And I said, have you been practicing? And he said, yes, I do Vipassana. And I said, well, did I explain Zen meditation to you? Yes. He said, well, when I come here, I do Zen, and when I'm somewhere else, I do Vipassana. I said, you can't do both. I said, you can't do both. And what I meant was, you can't do both well, right? If you're going to do Vipassana, do Vipassana. If you're going to do Zen, do Zen. It's not religious intolerance. You know, it's called wholeheartedness, right? It's wanting to do a little Vipassana and a little Zen is like surfing on the internet. It's like, I'll do Vipassana, but you know, I might be missing out on what Zen can teach. And I'll do Zen, but I might be missing out. It's like that mental illness. It's never good enough where you are. If you're going to, I'm not saying you can't read the Dalai Lama and practice Zen, but you can't do koan practice and Vipassana and do either of them very well, right? If you're going to practice Zen wholeheartedly. It doesn't have to be Zen. Whatever you do in life, do it wholeheartedly. You know. Basically about 6 months ago, maybe not that long, maybe 4 months ago, I was. It was the end of the second sitting period. So we have our first three periods, then we have the bathroom break, and then we have the second two. And I towards the end of the second sit of that, as 10:30 is approaching, I looked at my watch and I looked up and I noticed a glow, right, over at that end of the room. And, you know, it wasn't enlightenment. It was somebody checking his iPhone, you know. And I said, that is an addiction, you know. And that person has not come back. Right? Nevertheless, that is an addiction. See, that is somebody who is not capable of being wholehearted, honestly. You know, not wholehearted. If you're doing Zen, you came here to do Zen and you're checking your iPhone, you have a mental illness. So you have to, you have to be here 100%. You can't be, you can't do Zen halfway. See, so if you want to do Zen, you have to say I want to do Zen, and having the discipline, and the courage, and the commitment to follow any path in life wholeheartedly, is worth, any price. Right? Doesn't matter if it's Zen. But it's a way of life, right? And if you do something wholeheartedly, if you're wholeheartedly here, the interesting thing is it's so liberating. You stop worrying about what you're not doing, You know, I do Zen meditation three times in the evening here at Rutgers. And in the past, I've done it many, even, like six times. Right now, I'm down to three. But I've had to turn down a lot of parties, a lot of social events. And I have to tell you the truth, I have never once been unhappy to do that. Because I'm where I should be, right? Where I know I should be here. So I don't think about the party. I could have been at that party, blah blah blah. Then I swear to you, that never crosses my mind because I'm living my life from my this is my way, right? It's my chosen way, and I'm being true to my true nature. So if you want to practice Zen, you have to be, you don't have to do Zen morning, noon, and night, but you have to get up every day and do your meditation. You have to be committed to the path, and you have to give yourself wholeheartedly to your practice. And it doesn't have to be Zen, but if you try to do 20 different things in life, none of them are going to come to fruition, probably, Joshu spoke to the assembly and said, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." He's quoting from the verses we recite every morning, the Xin Xin Ming, the trust in mind, trust in mind. Joshu spoke to the assembly and said, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." And then this is a little different translation. "With but a single word, there may arise choice and attachment, or there may arise clarity." So he's quoting, and then he says, "This old monk does not have clarity. I don't have clarity. Do you appreciate the meaning of this or not?" Then a monk asked, "If you do not have clarity, what do you appreciate?" Joshu said, "I don't know that either." The monk said, "If you do not know, how can you say you do not have that clarity?" What Joshu is really saying here is that in Zen, our path is not knowing. Not knowing. It's not about clarity. It's about having the courage and the discipline to go through the doors in ourselves. We don't know what's on the other side of those doors. Knowing that would be clarity, but that's not how we live. We're going to open that door and see what happens, right? That's the Zen way of life. Joshu said, basically, opening the door is good enough. Now make your bows and retire. Secho's verse, "The great way is not difficult. Direct word, direct speech. One with many phases, two with one. Far away in the heavens, the sun rises, the moon sets. Beyond the hills, the high mountains, the cold waters. The skull has no consciousness, no delight. The dead tree sings in the wind, not yet rotten. Difficult, difficult. Attachment and clarity. Watch and penetrate the secret."